please. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 11-59, Bethany Lisa Pelz versus Federal Bureau of Investigation to have the comments of the appellant and not the evidence.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Cohn. I'm the attorney for Mr. Youssef, and with me at counsel table is Richard Renner, my co-counsel. The facts as set forth in the summary judgment record clearly supported a finding that the FBI failed to properly utilize the exceptional talents, expertise of its highest ranking and most qualified fluent Arabic-speaking agent, Mr. Bassem Youssef, in the direct aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. Under the case law of Burlington v. White, which explicitly recognizes that diminished job responsibilities is a classic form of discrimination or retaliation, summary judgment
should have been denied. What would be the standard we would use if we were to decide that there were diminished job responsibilities when he was transferred to Doc X? Is the standard that the work is less exciting than once before, less appealing?
No. In the facts of this case, there are some objective indicia, and there's also specific facts. He worked alongside of GS 10 and 11 non-agent FBI employees. He was a GS 15.
Have we used that before, who you work alongside of? I always thought we had used supervisory capacity, different supervisory capacity, or that the current job hadn't built upon previous expertise, but work alongside of? Do you know any cases that have done that? So that's what I want. I want you to tell me the cases that we've decided before about diminished responsibility and how it lines up.
Sure. Well, he was supervised by a GS 13 and a GS 14 while he was a GS 15. So he was being supervised by people at grade levels higher than him, had never happened before, highly unusual. But the type of work he was performing was at five levels plus lower than the expertise and qualifications he walked into that job on. And there is a case in the DC Circuit that specifically looks at someone who was working at a job level, I think it's the Holcomb case, five levels below. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The fact that he was performing duties that a GS 10 non-agent would be performing, that's the evidence that supports his affidavit that he was doing work far below his level of expertise. But also on this record, all you have to do is look at the jobs the FBI gave him before 9/11. He was arranging direct meetings and interfacing with the Minister of Interior of Saudi Arabia, the King of Saudi Arabia, the head of security for Egypt, using his language skills, his investigatory skills, in setting up some of the most sensitive and important exchanges of information.
Can I just
please
step back a moment? And this focus on the assignment to Doc X, which I understand, but in your brief, and certainly before the district court, you argued very much about a sort of general, and indeed you've used the term here, a general failure to use his skills. Is there, and the district court called that a theme, not a claim. Is there anything that's, any point of evidence that's relevant to that, that supports that claim, if it is a claim, and isn't relevant on the assignment to Doc X? In other words, Doc X is, whether or not it's adverse action, is very clearly the sort of action, it's an action of some sort. while the inaction in terms of failing to give him a job suitable to his experience and skill is a bit different and sort of free-floating. So do you lose anything in terms of sort of the basic thrust of your case by focusing exclusively on Doc X?
No, we actually are focusing on two circumstances. One was very unique, which was the use of human resources within the FBI directly after 9/11, when many agents, hundreds upon hundreds, were called up and put into sensitive counterterrorism positions, including people Mr. Youssef worked with. They were called up. They didn't apply for jobs because those jobs didn't even exist yet because the counterterrorism division hadn't been remade. They were called up. Youssef wasn't. Now, obviously, there were no. The second thing that happened,
specifically with that position, as opposed to the Doc X claim, to me, is that this inaction by whom? I mean, you can have inaction by someone before whom an application is pending, who dawdles on it or something like that. That I understand, and no particular problem. But this sort of inaction by a swarm, whereas the actual assignment to Doc X is an act by a particular person, and therefore fits into the ordinary lexicon of these things.
And I agree with that, except he reached out to three critical figures within the FBI who knew of his experience: Dale Watson, the assistant executive director over counterterrorism, counterintelligence, whom he worked with in Saudi Arabia, never returned the call, and the unit chief and section chief of the ITOS, the International Terrorism Operations Sections, which would have been the units for whom he should have been assigned. Also, there was this representative of the FBI, Mr. Cherniak, who then went around and tried to find him a job, because he was on a detail, and learned he was persona non grata, and no one wanted to use him.
Yeah.
Then
you're getting into the motivation question,
yeah,
which I think is obviously vital. But
okay. But then there was the Doc X assignment, and the Doc X assignment put him into a project which he was working five grades below.
I understand that. So I mean, basically, in terms of the, let's call it the inaction claim, you would pin it to three particular people he spoke to who in one way or another failed to respond. Is that correct?
Correct. It's the three people he spoke to plus the general environment where they were pulled up people whom he was working with. And with Cherniak has two pieces. The one is his inability to find him a position. That's when he was going around and asking some of these very same executives, hey, I have this guy Youssef. He's a tremendous expert. He's fluent in Arabic. He was the first legate in Saudi Arabia. He won the DCI award, the Director of Central Intelligence Award, for his incredible operational skills. Do you have a job for him? This is right after 9/11, when it's just on the public record that the FBI was desperate for these skills, and they shut the doors on him. Then he files the EEO, and he's put into Doc X project.
Can I?
Sure, please.
A reframing of your claim. I'm now moving to the motivation issue. Given the fact that there seems to be no evidence linking these rumors that he was persona non grata because he was mistakenly thought of as a Muslim. Which would not be the mistake would not be a defense anyway. But could it? Is your argument really a sort of res ipsa argument? Look, we have all this talent. We have a failure to use it at all. We have a failure even to explore using it. In those circumstances, the government's inaction is almost impossible to explain without the government coming forward with some affirmative explanation.
Your Honor, I agree with
the reformulation of your argument.
I understand. I agree with about three quarters of it.
Okay.
I think that because they were utilizing non-Arabs, for all these positions. And he was the only Arab we know who was even trying to get into these jobs on a discrimination case. You have disparate treatment. So it's a little more than just the evidence, but also is the circumstances in which Mr. Cherniak on his own developed the present sense impression that he was persona non grata. Persona non grata, that was his impression after he tried to find him a job. Cherniak.
But we don't have evidence from Cherniak tracing this impression to the decision makers or the non-decision makers, do we?
No, because the record would show that he was talking. The only thing that really happened was he started talking to the decision makers. He was going to people like Crusoe and Watson, who were the decision makers. And when he started the process, he was optimistic. Yeah, we'll get you a job. This is a no-brainer. But at the end of it, he concludes he's persona non grata. So it was in that process in which he was trying to find Yusuf a job that he forms that impression, which is not hearsay. Then
I understand the impression.
Yeah, and then he testifies
the question
to these terrible.
Whether there's evidence from which a jury can draw the inference of these anti-Muslim, anti-Arab sentiments.
And I would think that would come from his testimony that he then heard these rumors that confused Yusuf with the one and only other Egyptian agent who worked for the FBI. People thought Yusuf was this other agent, and they stereotyped Yusuf. Even Cherniak thought he was a Muslim when he wasn't. They thought he was this other agent. And then there's the affidavit of Mr. Paul Vick that said those rumors, very derogatory rumors, were held by others in the FBI, even at the senior executive service level, for years, even after this incident. So what we have is disparate treatment, clear disparate treatment, and we have this testimony of Cherniak and this switch of opinion from optimistic on getting him a job to a conclusion he's persona non grata after he interacts with officials and hears these rumors. So the other thing that's, I think, although the sua sponte summary judgment, I understand it's not the major issue, but the government never had to come up with this burden of production. They never articulated a legitimate business reason for not using his skills and services in the aftermath as a result of his communications, as a result of the Cherniak solicitations, and why they put him in Doc X versus anywhere else where those skills were needed. They never had to reach their burden because they didn't file on those issues. So your earlier statement that it's res ipsa loquitur, in some ways the reason we're in that vacuum is because the FBI never explained why his calls weren't returned or Cherniak couldn't place them. They never did. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, but I'm more than glad to answer any other questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Marquez from the Department of Justice, and I represent Appalachians. Here, the district court properly awarded summary judgment on all of plaintiffs' discrimination claims. Plaintiffs' argument here today ignores the context in which these claims arose. Plaintiff applied for only one position post 9/11. That was as unit chief of Doc X. He was selected as unit chief of Doc X. The district court.
Who's Doc X? Is that documents examiner?
Documents exploitation project.
Exploitation?
Yes. What it was, Your Honor, was the documents and electronic media had been discovered in Afghanistan and then were taken back, and they needed to be reviewed to determine whether they had intelligence value. And then
why is it that no particular language skill is necessary? As somebody said that, I was looking, I couldn't find it. For that position, if the documents were recovered in Afghanistan, were they all in English?
No, they weren't. And in fact,
Then how can it be that somebody's testified that no, in a deposition, that no particular language skills were necessary? How can that possibly be?
Well, Your Honor, there certainly needed to be people there who could translate the documents, but one reason that plaintiff was, his skills were indeed being utilized by the agency in his initial temporary assignment in DOCX before he applied and was selected as unit chief, is he had the skills not just to translate, but while he's translating the document to use his expertise to determine whether that document or electronic media would be of intelligence value in the 9/11 investigation.
What are we to make of the argument that he was supervised by people who had lower level?
Your Honor, like many of the allegations in plaintiff's briefs, he only has his own testimony and his own affidavit to support that. It's very distinguishable from, for example, the Holcomb case, where you had someone else at the agency, not just plaintiff, do an analysis and actually state in the record that the plaintiff was performing duties below grade level, in fact, several levels. Here,
I'm
plaintiff
would... You're saying that it's not in the record, it's a pure invention of the brief writer that he was supervised by someone with a lower GS rating?
Well, the plaintiff himself said that he was.
I mean, that's the way summary judgment works. If a jury could find the plaintiff credible...
Your Honor, and even assuming arguendo, if he were that temporary, I think, you know, for the one thing, the FBI did submit evidence of, you know, him continuing to be a GS-15 and to be in this, as I say, unique position vis-a-vis other people also working on the DOCX project, where he could use his language skills, and he himself in his deposition says he looked...
Haven't we relied upon facts like who's supervised by whom to determine whether it's an adverse employment action? And doesn't it certainly sound like if you go from one position to another, and in the second position you're being supervised by people with a lower grade, doesn't that sound like it's something adverse has taken place?
I think it depends on the context, Your Honor. Here the plaintiff was on a detail in which his original detail position had been eliminated, and he was only supervising one person for the 7 months prior to being changed over to DOCX. DOCX was started after 9/11. It was not, initially it wasn't placed anywhere in the FBI organizational structure, but eventually it was placed in counterterrorism. 5 months after plaintiff was there, he applied to be the unit chief. And
well,
then he
has an explanation for that, and that is that at that point, given the full context, that was the least bad way to go. Seems to me a jury could believe that.
But, Your Honor, I don't think that under, you know, the plaintiff was citing Burlington Northern, which is a retaliation case. The adverse action standard for discrimination claims is different, it's objective, and it doesn't, you know, rely on a reasonable person standard. There has to be an objectively significant diminishment of responsibilities, and the cases relied upon by plaintiff just have vastly different circumstances and extreme differences in supervisory authority or responsibilities. Here you have a plaintiff going...
You're recognizing it's a step backwards, but it's not a huge step backwards.
No, Your Honor, we are not recognizing that at all. We think that the FBI and the record had numerous people come forward and talk about the great importance of what plaintiff was doing in the DOCX project even before he was the unit chief.
A project can be important without drawing upon skills that a particular person doing it has manifested.
Yes, but again, by plaintiff's own testimony, he was looking at the documents, translating them, and determining, quote, and the district court also quoted this, whether they were worthwhile. That's in the joint appendix. And he also acknowledged that the doc...
sort of like that interesting project at Georgetown where the students were scoping out the underground tunnels in China. Students just stepping into this position, relying heavily on computerized translations from the Chinese.
I think it is different from that, Your Honor, because it was a 9/11 counterterrorism investigation, and again, we presented plenty of summary judgment evidence from FBI witnesses. For example, the Canale deposition that we cite in our brief, where they talk about just how important that project was to the FBI. And the context of this is they're just starting the project, and when it got underway, they had people temporarily detailed there. It was just a temporary transfer, and then when he applied to be unit chief, he was selected. And in fact, his own application, the other difference, Your Honor, you're right that if you have an affidavit supported by facts, that can be admissible summary judgment evidence. But here, when you have the plaintiff himself submit an application for unit chief, that counteracts his own current description of his duties. That makes a difference. I mean, this is not a motion to dismiss where you can just make conclusory allegations. And if he submits...
So what does he say in that?
In that, he says he submitted an application that included comments from the Assistant Director of Counterterrorism for the FBI in support of his application that says, Supervisory Special Agent Yusuf has been assigned to Doc X for approximately 7 months. As such, he has operational familiarity with managing the tremendous volume of documents and evidence obtained pursuant to overseas military raids. He is familiar with the processing and tracking of the evidence, the review of documents and electronic media for potential threat information, and the assignment of leads for additional investigation and intelligence exploitation. And that's on page 372 of the joint appendix. So here,
couldn't that all be true and still fall far short of dealing with Saudi princes involved in intelligence operations?
Your Honor, I think also with respect, the LEGAP position was ended back in 2000. And so he had been doing something else. He chose, that was a term position. And it's not a permanent position. You don't stay as LEGAT, indefinitely. And at the end of that, if he didn't want to go back to Los Angeles, then he needed to apply for another position, which he did, and he chose to apply for a detail. So he was detailed at another agency, at the CIA, and that was another difference between, him and people who were currently working in field offices such as New York, currently working on Al-Qaeda investigations. And he, in LEGAT, it's also
The record doesn't suggest that, as a general matter, people who were on some sort of temporary detail were universally excluded from those rounded up to respond to 9/11. Right?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And in fact, again, the FBI did do what plaintiff was asking for by assigning him to a position within the counterterrorism division from his detail. And so I think...
Is that your response to the disparate treatment argument, that in fact he got what he was entitled to and qualified for? And...
Yes, Your Honor, and our additional response is the district court was absolutely right that he hadn't, because he didn't apply for a position, he didn't demonstrate any kind of adverse action.
You heard counsel's argument that one component of the argument is that they didn't reach out to him in the first place, and that he did make some phone calls, but they weren't responded to. So can't that be evidence of disparate treatment? He was consciously overlooked because of misperceptions about who he was?
But Your Honor, I think there, again, has to be some kind of significant change in responsibilities if you're not alleging a failure.
Well, he's not. The change of responsibilities, new assignments are given in the wake of a national crisis, and he's not included in those. And he's not included in those because of misperceptions about who he is.
I don't think the failure to give someone additional duties than his current duties can qualify as a legally adverse action. And in any event, again, Your Honor, here the FBI did transfer him to a counterterrorism position. And there were, it is...
You speak as if counterterrorism positions were fungible. They don't seem at all fungible to me.
Well, Your Honor, again, there were, as the district court found, that it was undisputed that plaintiff didn't apply for any of the openings that were advertised on the FBI computer database. Temporary details.
Is that the only way? Is that the only way to get a job? Is that the only way jobs are parceled out in the counterintelligence world? Is you go to the website and see what's there? That's not how jobs are handled, well, particularly in the wake of emergency. Things are fast moving. Jobs become open. People call one another. It's not just looking at the website and seeing what's posted, is it?
Yeah, but apart from the very, very initial aftermath, right after, immediately following 9/11, where, again, you know, plaintiff wasn't at FBI headquarters or in a field office, then the FBI did post its positions. And you're right, there are various ways of finding out about those jobs, but it's incumbent upon plaintiff, if he's not at a field office or headquarters, to actually make the efforts. And all he did is make a few phone calls here. And when a message wasn't returned,
phone calls, which let's say a jury could reasonably find are directed in a reasonable direction, and all you get is a very, very cold shoulder. Does applying formally for a job look like a promising tactic at that point?
You need to make a much, much stronger showing than that, Your Honor. You would have to show that it would be futile to apply for a job. And the district court already rejected plaintiff's arguments in the context of he also had a claim about failure to obtain an SES position, and he's not appealing that here. But in that context, the district court actually found from the record evidence that the vast majority of SES positions were, you know, posted and competitively, and that, I mean, they're all posted and competitively decided, but there were only, I think, three examples of where people had already been acting. So it's the futility argument was rejected. He hasn't made the requisite showing for summary judgment purposes.
We're reviewing the decision that rejected it.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You say the district court rejected it, but we're reviewing that decision.
Yes, though his claims on appeal are not for a failure to promote or a non-selection claim. He made some of those claims in district court. In fact, that was the very focus of the district court litigation. He's not appealing those. His claim is just, it's epitomized in his reply brief when he actually states that he was ready, willing, and available to receive a position or a job or the significant responsibilities, that it basically is that he had a legal expectation that the FBI would come to him. And that is not, that does not support an adverse action claim. And his other claim is just about the transfer to DOCX. So he's not making a failure to promote, failure to select, and he can't because the one position post 9/11 he applied for, he got.
Did the government offer a specific justification for the assignment to DOCX as opposed to saying it was not a problem?
Your Honor, the government has consistently maintained the importance of the DOCX position.
Well, but suppose we were not persuaded by that, so that one gets to the question, to the next phase, whether the government has offered a non-discriminatory reason for what it did.
Your Honor. In fact, we state if this court does disagree with us in adverse action, we think that the record supports affirming the district court on the alternative ground. And there, it's the plaintiff's burden to come forward. And here, he's alleged these rumors, but not only are they hearsay, but as Your Honor pointed out in a question, there was no...
But I think you're jumping over a step that I think is normally required, and that is that the assuming we have an adverse action and he has been put in something that no one else who lacks his particular ethnicity and rumored religion, I guess we have to say, that hasn't happened to anyone else. At that point, doesn't the burden shift to the government to come up with a non-discriminatory reason for it?
Your Honor, assuming we were at that point, yes, as we state in our brief, the clearest refutation of plaintiff's attempt to create this inference of discriminatory animus is that the FBI decision makers in question, who were heading the counterterrorism division, selected him to be unit chief and a supervisor of a counterterrorism position that they considered
to be... His argument really has that it seems to me it would be one thing if the complaint alleged or the EEOC complaint alleged that this position was one of diminished responsibilities. But that's not the claim. The claim is my talents could be used better elsewhere. Not that, I mean, and you could probably say that. I mean, if he were suddenly appointed head of a government agency, he could say the same thing. My talents, I'm an Arab-speaking individual born in Egypt. My talents would be better utilized someplace else. But that does not mean that the position to which he applied and got selected was a diminished responsibility. I just don't find that claim.
And we don't either, Your Honor. And I agree that is essentially what he's arguing, is that my abilities could have been used differently and I would have preferred different work assignments.
Let me ask you, let's imagine, just hypothetical, let's imagine there was an email out there that said, because he's Egyptian, because he's Muslim, wrongly, let's put him in the DocX program. Let's imagine that email existed. Does he have a claim there, under your theory?
Well, I assume the email is...
Right.
It's assuming that DocX is not a good position. I mean, we would say no because...
Because DocX is not a... Not,
it's not, not a just diminution. No, there's no adverse action there, and you have to have a prima facie case of discrimination. That's a hurdle you have to clear before, even getting to the last step. Okay. So we would still say the district court should be affirmed. But again, we think the district court could also be affirmed even if there were an adverse action.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Cohen, I think you have about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In regard to the DocX position, the FBI described it itself as one, and this is to quote, to review, serialize, bait stamp, and scan documents so they could be later retrieved. That was the essence of the job. The documents were coming from Afghanistan, where the primary languages used are Pashto and Dari, not Arabic. He was not there as a translator. If he was, the FBI would be conceding he would have been placed at a level way below, five levels below his GS-15 status. He was not a translator. When he worked in Saudi Arabia, he interacted on the same language with people like the Minister of Interior or the head of the Mabaith. He wasn't translating for them. He was working with them, cooperating, building liaison. I think this case is very similar to the Zelazky v. Peters case that this circuit decided. They explicitly applied Burlington v. White to a discrimination case. They found that despite the fact that the position was, quote, of extreme importance to the agency, it still was raised inference of discrimination. And
would you describe for me succinctly exactly what the adverse employment action was? What your claim is?
The adverse employment action was the failure to utilize Mr. Youssef and placing him into positions that were radically below his status, both in terms of as a supervisor and his 20 years of incredible experience and expertise.
Placing him in a position where he didn't have to use his language skills, is that the idea?
That would be part of it, but he had...
But what's the rest of it?
Well, he had operational investigatory counterterrorism expertise for which he got the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence Award. He coordinated the most important Middle Eastern counterterrorism investigations pre-9/11, including the trade bomb case and others. He had major duties. So someone might be retrieving some documents.
If the FBI did not place him in a counterterrorism unit, which demanded the use of his language skills, that's an adverse employment action under your lights.
What you would look at, that would be a major fact supporting that finding. In this case, there are additional facts, not just language. And those facts are that he was supervised by people below his level, that the type of work he was doing could have been performed by a GS-10 non-agent, and he's a GS-15.
Let me just get one other fact clear before you sit down. Did he apply for any positions that met your qualifications, that used all his skills? Did he ever apply for such a position?
He submitted no. During the time period at issue, he did not submit a formal application, primarily because those positions were being created and filled in place right after 9/11. It wasn't that the FBI didn't need these positions, but to go through the formal process of establishing a job, getting congressional approval, etc. They had the positions in place, and our brief cites to that. But I just want to add just one thing, if I may, which is he did call the top officials whom he knew, and Cherniak had the duty to try to find him a job. It was part of his job, and it was unsuccessful. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.